Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yay! Boo! That's pretty much today's economic news from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 26th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, it will come as news to nobody who's an even occasional listener to this program that this economy right now is real tough to read. And the latest confirmation of that came this morning in the form of the first peek at gross domestic product for the October to December quarter of 2022. You look real quick, a glance perhaps, or you listen to the headlines, and you see that on the one hand, it's pretty good. Annualized growth of 2.9% at the end of last year. But you look a little deeper and you see on the other hand, it's lower growth than we saw in the third quarter of last year. And there are some signs that parts of this economy are dragging. So, to get a sense of things, while honoring that axiom of economics that there is always another hand, we sent two reporters off this morning to talk to the same economists and bring back two different stories of this economy. One of them good, one of them bad. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
I drew the positive spin on GDP straw in our news meeting this morning, and it's hard to get more positive than this.
You know, this is pretty good stuff. We get a very resilient set of growth numbers.
That's Joe Bruswellis at RSM Consulting.
For the overall year, the economy expanded at 2.1%. Despite a very challenging growth picture, where an economy is absorbing the twin shocks of inflation and interest rates.
Those rising borrowing costs for mortgages and credit cards and business loans barely seem to have dented economic activity, says Megan Green at the Kroll Institute.
The headline figure surprised on the upside at 2.9% for the fourth quarter. It's just the details were a little bit more disappointing.
Okay, but wait for that. We'll get to the GDP disappointment beat in about 2 minutes. Back to the upside.
The good news is consumption was still fairly strong for both goods and services.
Spending by businesses also held up pretty well, says Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics.
Business investment overall increased 0.7% annualized in the context of the huge rise in interest rates we've had. That is reasonably encouraging.
One big boost to economic activity came from an increase in business inventories.
We saw inventories add essentially almost half the headline gain.
That's economist Sarah House at Wells Fargo.
Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, inventories are a little bit in the eye of the beholder.
Which brings us to the negative, glass-half-empty version of GDP, so I'm out of here. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell's out, Justin Ho's in, same economists, different economy, here you go.
Let's start with the buildup in inventories that happened last quarter. Remember Joe Bruswellis at RSM? He says we shouldn't get too excited about that.
That makes sense, ahead of the holidays. That's a one-time thing and not going to be replicable.
And while the inventory buildup could be a sign that businesses are feeling confident,
it could also mean that businesses have been caught off guard by the demand environment, and so they've had unintended inventory building.
That's Sarah House at Wells Fargo again. She says demand has been weakening. Another sign is that imports to the U.S. were down.
With imports falling, it's a sign that businesses have restocked their inventories sufficiently and that they see fading signs of consumer demand where they just don't need as much product.
And even though consumer spending did rise last quarter, more recent retail sales data found that spending fell in both November and December. Here's Andrew Hunter again at Capital Economics.
Although the quarter as a whole was okay, the degree of momentum and strength was fading as the quarter went on.
Consumer spending had been propped up by all the relief aid people got during the pandemic. But Megan Green at the Kroll Institute says people have been burning through their savings.
The question is, how long can they whittle that down before they run out? And I think they'll probably run out at some point this year.
Green says if consumer spending keeps falling, more companies might lay off workers. We asked Joe Bruzuelas at RSM about whether he thinks the economy will enter a recession this year.
We think there's a 65% probability of a recession, most likely starting around mid-year. That means there's 35% probability that we won't.
Is that a good sign or a bad one? I guess it depends on what you think of those odds. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
You will be shocked, shocked, I know, to hear that Wall Street put on its rose-colored glasses to read today's GDP report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For you and for me and the general American consuming public, the holiday shopping season is long behind us. Retailers, though, are still smack in the middle of their holiday hangover returns season. Because after we bring something back to the store, or drop it in the mail more often nowadays, retailers have a whole lot of work to do. And it's not as simple as just putting things back on the shelves, you know. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab went into the belly of the retail returns beast.
The Costco returns warehouse in Monroe Township, New Jersey, looks kind of like a busy ant farm. There's constant movement as workers unload trucks, stack pallets onto forklifts, and whisk them away to different parts of the facility. Returns from more than 60 stores, plus the region's online orders, come here. This place is big. 860,000 square feet. That's 15 football fields. Employees stand at rows of conveyor belts carrying a hodgepodge of items. Judy Tiano is inspecting a plastic storage bin.
So fortunately with this right here, the lid is broken. So basically it's 50% of the product.
She scans the bin and sends it down the line, where it'll be packed up and sold to a third-party seller, a liquidator. It's where a lot of these returns go. Even things that look brand new. An unused suitcase without a tag, a perfectly good football in a ripped box. Not everything is resellable, though. Tianyo picks up a bath mat.
See, there's a stain right there. A couple of stains in this one, so I might just have to donate it.
Tianyo handles more than 1,000 items a day, so she's become a bit of a Costco encyclopedia. Like, at one point, a blanket without a barcode rolls down the line, and she magically knows exactly where to find it in her computer. For Costco, this kind of knowledge is priceless because the store sells a huge variety of stuff and each item has its own returns protocol. Brandy O'Hara is the company's director of return operations.
It's not one size fits all for every product. Everything you touch has a different story. It's almost like a 31 flavors of returns.
Take electronics. These days, most contain user data, like a Spotify account or credit card number, so they're either returned to the manufacturer or sold to a liquidator that wipes sensitive information. It means any returned TV must be resold as an open box item. Other products have no resale value at all. O'Hara says Costco donates all returned bikes because of liability problems. And personal hygiene items?
As much as we feel like you can change a toothbrush head, and that you still have this really good toothbrush or, you know, other personal hygiene items, there's just really not a market for it.
Instead, it gets recycled. Finally, plenty of products aren't worth the hassle of inspection. Why pay employees to unbox, plug in, and test $30 coffee makers if you can quickly sell them to liquidators and recoup part of the cost? In fact, this is what most stores do, send returns directly to liquidators without inspection. Only big chains like Costco are investing in their own returns technology.
It's a cost of doing business no matter what you do. So how can we get the most value out of that cost?
Value because the return side of the business is about recovering money. The National Retail Federation says in 2022, Americans returned more than $800 billion worth of goods. That's like the GDP of Switzerland. O'Hara says reverse logistics, that's the fancy industry term for returns, has exploded with online shopping.
You have that tendency that sight unseen, I have this permission. I tend to take additional liberties if I'm doing an online return.
I order two sizes.
It's like, yeah, absolutely. I order two vanities and I want to see which one I like, which one goes with my flooring.
Shoppers are up to 4 times more likely to return online purchases, according to the Reverse Logistics Association. It's why many logistics experts think more retailers will start charging return shipping or restocking fees or get rid of generous return policies. That's not happening anytime soon at Costco, which is famous for its policy. Unlimited returns despite condition or purchase date, with some exceptions. Warehouse worker Judy Tiano says people do take advantage of it.
I've seen headphones that's completely like broken in half, they would return. I have one time, I have a toaster that was bought in 2001. Let it go.
For now, Costco says its return policy is more valuable to its bottom line than the huge production it takes to handle returns. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You want to know more about those liquidators Kristen was talking about, don't you? That is part two. It's coming tomorrow. A good number of us just don't work the way we used to. That is the number one change that the pandemic's had on the American labor force. Most of us don't work the way we used to, and we don't work where we used to. Those who can are choosing to work from home or elsewhere, but in any case, remotely, not in an office. Seattle, Washington, it turns out, is number 2 nationally for the biggest share of people working remotely, so says the Census Bureau. And it won't surprise that in that city, there has thus been more demand for co-working spaces. Audrey Hoyt owns the Pioneer Collective. That's an independent co-working space in Seattle and Tacoma.
Business is going quite well, actually. I say quite just because it's been so challenging to navigate the last 3 years for us. And so it's always scary to acknowledge that like things are good right at this moment. We've had a huge increase in co-working memberships and demand for that, as well as meeting room rentals. And I'm in one of our spaces today, and there's a lot of people in here, and it feels really good to kind of have that dynamic activity again. I'd say in Seattle, it's been very quiet. It's been a slow restart here as far as people going back to the office. We have one business in downtown Seattle, one of our locations, and it's been a really quiet 2 years as far as foot traffic in the neighborhood and office workers in the area. Co-working, on the other hand, like individuals coming in and utilizing our spaces, we still have a lot of people doing that sort of thing. My husband and I started this business 7 years ago. We're the only owners, and dealing with trying to survive during the pandemic and navigate any sort of opportunity to help us stay afloat, but then all of the paperwork and administration of that sort of thing, coupled with increased competition just from, you know, larger operators. We are definitely noticing rising costs of all of our supplies. Inflation's big for us, and we're noticing with our members and customer base, they are concerned about rising costs. They're more reluctant to commit to things and are citing those effects as far as, you know, we have a lot of individuals who say they've had a change in financial circumstances and absolutely love the space but can't afford to keep being a part of it and paying for a membership. I certainly hope that small businesses will survive, particularly brick and mortar. I think brick and mortar is what's been really hit in a city like Seattle, and that totally disappoints me because I feel like brick and mortar businesses that are small and local create the fabric of our communities. I am also really hopeful from watching our customer base. People are so wonderfully supportive, and they care about trying to figure out how we can support and maintain smaller businesses and unique local shops. So I'm really, really hopeful that, you know, as a community, we all come out and figure out ways to just keep our neighborhoods thriving.
Coming up,
we looked at this price when person A signed a lease. Now the person B is signing a lease. What's the price changed?
Anyone? Anyone? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 205 today, 0.6%, finished at 33,949. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 199, that's on points. 1.75 is the percent scale, ended at 11,512. The S&P 500 up 44 points, 1.1%, 4,060. Tesla accelerated nearly 11% because yesterday the EV maker posted better than expected earnings and revenue for the fourth quarter. Shares also got a boost after Elon Musk, the CEO, as you know, said the company might be able to produce 2 million cars this year. Might is doing a lot of work in that sentence. Southwest Airlines dipped 3.1% after reporting a net loss of $220 million in the fourth quarter. Much of that, of course, due to canceling more than 16,000 flights over the holidays. You remember that. United Airlines gave back 1.6%. Delta down 0.4%. Chevron up 4.8% today after announcing a $75 billion share buyback. The company said the move would boost its dividend payout to investors, too. ExxonMobil up 4%. Bond prices went the other way down. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.50%. We take it out to the decimal points with bonds because that matters. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We told you yesterday about maybe kind of sort of some promise in the housing market. Redfin reporting the first bump in pending home sales in quite a while. Today, there is news from the Commerce Department that actual new home sales did pick up in December. 2.3%, if you're looking for specifics. The third consecutive monthly increase versus a year ago, though, down more than 26%. As Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, one thing weighing on those home sales, a whole lot of buyers are backing out of their contracts.
Earlier this month, KB Homes, one of the largest builders in the country, said 68% of its orders for new homes last quarter were canceled. That's more than two-thirds. Allie Wolf follows the market as chief economist at Zonda. She says the national cancellation rate is now about 20%, but that's twice the typical rate.
Reason one comes down to affordability.
Building a new home takes months, even a year, and a lot can change between the time a buyer puts down a deposit and locks in a mortgage rate to close the deal.
So if someone signed a contract early last year, they thought they were buying at a 3% interest rate, and now they're buying at a 6% interest rate.
They may no longer qualify for a mortgage or just decide they can no longer afford it. Wolf says cancellations have been higher in places where prices really shot up during the pandemic.
Areas like Denver or Austin, where now affordability is really getting stretched.
Buyers are also canceling because they're having trouble selling their current house in a sluggish market, or especially in tech hubs, because they lost their job. Robert Frick is an economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. He says as home prices grow more slowly and even fall in some markets, some buyers are getting cold feet.
The idea of buying into a market that is falling and then immediately having, you know, negative equity in your home, that scares a lot of people.
For builders, canceled contracts can slow down construction, says Clint Mitchell, CEO of Estridge Homes in Indianapolis. During the market boom, it was easy to find another buyer, but
if the market has weakened, then it's going to be harder to get that new buyer. You may have to provide some incentives or discounting to do that.
That's happening, and some buyers are canceling because they can get a better deal from another builder. But as mortgage rates have come down a little recently, Mitchell says he's seeing cancellations slow down too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, let's do a little more housing now. Not so much the nuts and bolts of buying and selling that Amy was talking about, but instead, housing prices, rent specifically, and how rent gets factored into the very macroeconomically critical inflation calculations that the Federal Reserve and all of the rest of us are so tuned into right now. Most times when rent is considered inflation-wise, it's all rent that's included. New leases, old leases, ongoing leases, all of them. Late last year, though, the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Cleveland Fed tried something new, only looking at new leases when they did their inflation math. And thus we have something called the New Tenant Repeat Rent Index, which is, I grant you a bit of a mouthful, but economics writer Joseph Politano says it is actually the most important new inflation indicator out there. Joseph, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I guess, first of all, we need to establish a little ground truth here, and I need you to explain for me how the government typically tracks rent inflation with a consumer price index, which is what most people are familiar with.
Right. So housing is a really big deal in the consumer price index. It's about a third of the total basket. It's the biggest single item. Mm-hmm. And so the government has to be really careful about how they're measuring it. They want to get it precisely right. And so what they do essentially is come up with a big sample of housing units. Every 6 months, they go and visit those housing units and record, you know, what the price is, if there was any change in the amenities, if the unit was renovated, and so on. Mm-hmm. And they use that to back out an estimate for rent prices in the United States and also in, you know, your local city area. And they extrapolate that rent estimate for homeowners, too.
Right. And that's that thing that we've talked about on the program. It's called owner's equivalent rent. But let me ask you this. It's not like people, whatever the sample that the BLS uses, it's not like people are signing new rental agreements every month, right? So that number gets stale.
Precisely. It lags by about a year. So you can imagine at the start of the pandemic,
right,
somebody records the price of an apartment in New York in January 2020. They don't come back and visit that apartment until June of 2020.
Right.
And that apartment might not sign a new lease until January of 2021. So you have this, you know, earth-shattering change in the housing market that happens at the start of the pandemic, and it really doesn't fully show up until a full year later.
And now, as we're worried about inflation, and by we, I mean specifically the Federal Reserve, right? Them having year-old data is kind of a challenge.
Yeah, it's a really big challenge. Housing is one of the biggest parts of inflation, and it's one of the parts that the Federal Reserve, that monetary policy, most heavily influences.
Right. Right. And we see that in mortgage rates and all the rest of it that we've talked about. So, to the point of this conversation and the reason we got you on the phone, this thing called the New Tenant Repeat Rent Index. First of all, layman's terms, please, what does that mean?
So what that means essentially is you take the official data that looks at all housing and you want to throw out everything where there hasn't been a new person moving in. So you have the subset of units where someone moves in, replaces the previous tenant, signs a new lease, mm-hmm. and you're going back and comparing and saying, okay, we looked at this price when person A signed a lease. Now the person B is signing a lease. What's the price changed? And because you're only looking at the subset, you get a much more real-time view of what the housing market looks like, what housing inflation is going to look like.
So if you could get Jay Powell on the phone, which, you know, maybe you could, I don't know, what would you tell him about how the Fed thinks about housing specifically as it relates to inflation? Are they behind the curve, as it were?
I think the Fed understands this dynamic much more than people tend to give them credit for. What I would say, if you're talking to Jerome Powell right now, is, you know, the core driver of inflation is to some extent nominal income growth, like what's the growth in people's ability to spend.
Right.
And that translates really strongly to growth in housing prices, growth in rents. We've seen a pretty substantial deceleration in the growth in nominal income. And I'm confident that if that gets back down to a normal level, the core of housing inflation will follow. And so while this index is really useful, especially because things like household formation, so people deciding whether or not they want to move in together or live separately or stay with their parents or whatnot, can influence housing prices beyond just incomes, I think the core thing you have to look at is still income growth.
Right. And the takeaway from this thing, this index then now, is that because housing is such a huge factor in inflation in this economy, that directly impacts literally what people do with their lives, household formation, all of that stuff.
Yep, exactly.
Joseph Politano, he writes on economics. His newsletter is called Aprigatas Economics. Joseph, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Final note on the way out today, at the end of which I will offer just a tad bit of shameless self-promotion. I read this in the Washington Post this morning that Republicans in the House of Representatives are going to be holding a series of seminars to make sure that their members know what they are talking about in the looming fight over the debt limit as the GOP tries to leverage the full faith and credit of the United States for their policy goals. They will be covering stuff like what the debt limit is, what happens if it gets breached, and what the difference is between that and a plain old government shutdown, which is a lot, by the way, all of which are important for elected representatives to know, and all of which also they could learn by listening to this program. Just saying. All right, we are going here, though, is your moment of economic context. Really, it's more of a reminder than anything. PCE comes out tomorrow. That's the Fed's favorite measure of inflation. You try saying that 10 times fast. It'll be their last big data input before their next meeting, which is next Tuesday and Wednesday. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Card, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.